Welcome to the next episode of the Force North podcast. Just before we get going, I'd just like to mention that the call for papers for Force North 2021 runs out on Sunday. So if you feel inspired, you have two more days to join the fun. And with no further ado, let's go back to the podcast. And Cornelius Schumacher, please tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, hey, thanks for inviting me. Telling about myself, I think most people know me from my open source work in the KDE community and others. So I'm involved there for I think more than two decades now. I started out when I was still working in physics at the university, and there I got to know KDE from some colleagues, which were excited, and this dragged me into the project, and yeah, I never left after that. So that was how my open source career started. And when I left the university, I joined my first Linux distribution, Caldera, back then, a long time ago, doesn't exist anymore. And I think the longest time I worked for SUSE Linux, that's where I did a lot of work in different areas, but also still having KDE work and other open source work on the side. And nowadays I'm working at Deutsche Bahn, the German railway company. So I'm at DB Systel there. My role there is called the open source steward. So I'm responsible for the open source framework there.
It's open source software and also contribute to open source. That's
cool. Yeah, and the reason for pulling your hair is to discuss a bit about Qt licensing. But primarily the KDE Free Qt Foundation and sort of the setup around it, because it's a bit interesting to me. Qt is dual licensed, and then we have the Free Qt Foundation to sort of make the obligations in the other direction, to simplify things.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting setup. I think it's really interesting because it's also a very old setup. So if you think about the dual licensing model of Qt, that was when Qt started to do that, it was one of the first dual licensing model with combining an open source license with a proprietary license. So nobody had experience with that back then. And the founders of Trolltech, they back then when they started Qt, they had this idea in mind that they want to support the free software open source communities. Well, back then the term open source wasn't around yet, so it was really in the ancient times. The thing was that they had this idea in mind that they wanted to support the free software communities, but of course also they needed to think about how to run their business and how to earn the money to fund the development of Qt. And a lot of things back then are now taken for given. So I think we know how to operate this, but back then it was experimentation to some degree. And I think the great success at the beginning was that this model of making Qt available for free software worked out very well, because KDE was founded and picked Qt up and used it and did a lot of work with that and attracted a lot of people. A lot of people working on KDE software using Qt, so Qt users, developers using Qt. And Trolltech back then was a small company. They just had a handful of developers or something like that, and the KDE community was already attracting hundreds. So I think this model was really successful. And then the interesting thing, what also happened there, that the license of Qt back then was not open source, and it was a homegrown license to the best of the knowledge of the people who did that, but it wasn't accepted by everybody. And I mean, those people who have been around at that time still remember that there was really a controversy around the Qt license, and the KDE project also got a lot of pushback from people who said, okay, you are using a non-free license, and
that was in the
setup there. And from this point of view, I think the idea to do something about that then resulted in this agreement, this community contract, as I call it, with the KDE Free Qt Foundation. But the idea was to make some guarantees to make sure that the freedom of Qt would be preserved for the community, that the community could rely on Qt being available also in the long term. I sometimes refer to it as the license, because the license is there to allow to use it and so on. And later Qt was released under an open source license, so even put under the GPL at some point. So then in principle, the problem of the lacking freedom of the licenses was solved. But the license only gives you the rights to the code you already have, and it doesn't say anything about what to do with that in the future. And that's where the agreement comes in, where it gives additional guarantees, which go in the future, so that the community can be sure that KDE can use Qt as free software also in the future. And the company has this obligation to keep it free and maintain it and release it. And if not, then the agreement triggers and the community gets the right to release it under permissive license, under the BSD license. So this would then allow to create business models around that, which are similar to Qt and something like that. So from this point of view, the KDE Free Qt Foundation really is an innovation. It was relatively simple at the beginning. I think the negotiations and the thinking about that was probably quite complex, but the result was just a 3-page document, so quite simple. Over time, it has evolved and has become more complicated and more complex, because then all the different parts were also looked at, what parts of Qt to consider and how to define things properly, what is Qt and what not. And these things then added additional complexity. So I think I'm not aware of the same kind of agreement in other projects. So I think it's a pretty unique thing. One of the questions is that a good thing, or are some projects missing out on this opportunity to do more than just the licensing? I mean, we see a lot of fights also about licensing and about why should I contribute to a project which is owned by a company? And you have to find answers to that. And the KDE Free Qt Foundation agreement is, I think, one of the answers which is out there, which allows that and gives a motivation to do it.
To me, it's even a guarantee towards the customers, because I think the agreement triggers also if the Qt company would go bankrupt, which means that then you get the product as BSD and can sort of continue developing it, hopefully jointly in the open, but you even proprietary customers can sort of continue with it.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is, you always have this risk with these single vendor projects where a vendor is controlling the complete project and has all the rights to release it, and nobody else has the same level of rights. And this obviously is a risk for everybody, not only for a community, but also for any company using it. And the KDE Free Qt Foundation agreement is a way to address this risk in some way.
I'm a bit curious, when you wrote the first contracts of this kind, were there lawyers involved?
There were lawyers involved. It was actually fun to do the research for the presentation I did at FOSDEM about the KDE Free Qt Foundation, because there I talked to a lot of people. I wasn't around at that time, so I joined KDE shortly after, around before the KDE 2 release, and the work with the KDE Free Qt Foundation, or that happened around the KDE 1 release. So that's mostly before my time. But then I talked to the people who were involved, tried to find them. It wasn't that easy, but I had some interesting conversations also with Eirik, one of the founders of Trolltech, who shared some interesting thoughts and historical emails with me. That was really insightful. And one thing he said is that the pivotal point for the agreement was the first KDE developer meeting in Germany in 1996, I guess. And at that time, the Trotec people, they came to Germany, joined the KDE people for the meeting. They discussed technology, of course, but also had these discussions. And there the proposal was brought forward. And they had the discussions about that, how to do that. They also had an idea what how this should be. But then Trotec wanted to do it properly, and they hired actually a prestigious lawyer to finalize this. It was fun to hear the story about how hard it is to convince a lawyer to write such an agreement where you give up some of the things you own forever without any way to get them back. But in the end, they found this construction. And I think from a legal point of view, it's a very sound construction.
Has it changed a lot over time? I mean, Qt's licensing has changed. So I mean, then that's the background of my question. I mean, first you had the QPL, and then I guess it moved gradually over to GPL2, I would assume, or two or later, starting with X11, and then I think OS X came when OS X came with X11 support, the Mac branch was released, and then finally the Windows support. And then with Nokia times, it moved to LGPL to many of the modules, but not all. I think tools were still GPL, if I recall correctly. And now we're sort of seeing the introduction of various GPL v3 and LGPL v3 versions for modules as we transition from 5 to 6 or from 5.6 to 5.7. I think there was an update as well.
Yeah. There are tons of details there, and I think that this is what mostly changed in the agreement. So the fundamental construction with the licensing, that's still there, but all the details have changed, of course. So the Qt modules, how the Qt release is called, what is included, the licenses, of course, that's an important part. And in the text, what mostly has changed is trying to define things in a clearer way and adapt them to what is happening. So, and this actually has grown the agreement by, I don't know, a factor of 3 or 4 or something in size. So if you read the agreement now, it's very detailed and contains definitions for everything and so on. I think one really interesting aspect is that the agreement from the beginning is a very simple one, but the effect it had was not only that this guarantee would be in place for the case things go wrong, but it also has led to this constant conversation between the KDE community and the Qt company, because there is a provision to have regular meetings and so on in the KDE Free Qt Foundation. And all the license changes were things which were discussed in advance with the KDE community. So KDE always had a table there in the negotiations about future licenses and so on. And this, I think, is a very healthy thing because it also creates this feedback channel for a company to not change things unilaterally and then things are bad or badly constructed or they miss things or they worked against their own users or own customers. But in this case, I think this ongoing conversation is a very healthy thing and helped, I think, also to shape the right balance there between community interests and company interests. So, and in the end, I think is one of the critical factors for the success of Qt in the long term.
Yeah.
So, if I simplify as much as I possibly can, the contract is there's a trigger and then there is some kind of action.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what? Can you describe the trigger? What triggers the action to happen?
So the trigger is when Qt isn't released, or more precisely, the free edition of Qt, so the edition which KDE uses, is not released anymore, not maintained by the company anymore, and it's defined what that means in the contract, and there's a period the community has to wait, so that's 12 months. So when the company owning Qt fails to release a significant update of Qt, of the free edition, for more than 12 months, then the trigger becomes active, and then the foundation can decide, so the KDE Free Qt Foundation. So that's actually one thing you also have to understand, that there are third parties involved. There's the company, there's the KDE community, and there's a third organization, the KDE Free Qt Foundation, with the only purpose of holding the rights on the agreement and being the contract partner there. So that's one indirection to make it safer against requests in terms of bankruptcy and so on. Then the KDE Free Qt Foundation, which consists of representatives of the Qt company and the KDE community, can do this release under the BSD license. And the KDE community for these cases has the majority in the board of the KDE Free Qt Foundation. So effectively, the community can decide against the will of the company if they fail to release these significant updates. So that's the exact construction there. And this has been there from the beginning, and that's exactly the same today. So only what means KDE, what means Qt Free Edition, what are the licenses and so on, all these things, they have been refined. So for example, the platforms have been included over time. So at the beginning, it was just X-Windows, and Windows was not, so Microsoft Windows was not included in the contract, and this has been added much, much later, actually.
Yeah, I'm trying to recall. There was modularization with Qt 3, wasn't there? So that must have affected it. And then that was taken further in Qt 4 and Qt 5. And there's been various instances of like commercial modules. I'm trying to come up with one. When Qt charts, for instance, I think has always been commercial. So I guess that's outside of the contract and an add-on that the Qt company sells as a commercial only thing.
Yeah. And that also always was one of the fears, which was there, that there would be kind of a loophole which would allow to move things out of Qt itself to other products, call it differently, and in this sense make the Qt framework less valuable or remove essential components. And of course, I mean, it's a real problem, and then the lawyers come into play and have to define what that actually means and how to prevent that. And there's language in the contract which tries to achieve that.
One of the reasons for having you on right now is that there's been some controversy around Qt 6, as I understand it. But perhaps I can summarize it in my words, and you can correct me. But my understanding is that the trigger only applies to the current latest branch, so to speak. That's what needs to be maintained in the open, and that Qt 6 then was released and took over, but Qt 6.0 is sort of not feature complete. It does not contain all the modules. Then we're targeting Qt 6.2 or something. So during that transition time, the contract sort of fails, because the interesting branch is the latest 5 dot something, but the contract points to the 6 dot something. Is that a good picture of the controversies from the past months?
Yeah. I mean, the scope of the discussions which have been happening over the last couple of months is bigger than just what is covered by the agreement, because the agreement really is pretty focused on the availability and not so much about the details. And that's why there's no branching structure defined, or a number of stable branches or duration you have to maintain. It's a general availability, and this can be fulfilled by having one version which provides everything. And the same with the open source licenses. I mean, you can release code under the GPL, but that doesn't enforce you to do a specific development model or to maintain your software in a specific way. And of course, there are expectations in the whole setup, where you want some guarantees, or you want some services, or you want to have some collaboration in a specific way. So how we do things in the open source community, and this I think is always the balance between business and community. As a company, of course, you have to ask yourself the question, how do I get my money? And that's the purpose of a company. For the community, of course, this isn't a question. So you have to balance that. And there are different approaches to that. And I think over time, obviously, this has changed. The company was bought several times, went through different stages of also commercial success. And obviously, the drivers and the motivation, also the market around, has changed, obviously, over the last 20 years. So from this point of view, I think the current setup is... you have to understand, I think, the whole scope to make sense of what is happening there. From the agreement, I would say... I think always, and that has always been the case, is that the Qt company was willing to fulfill it and was respectful to the community. Depending on the face and the company and the people, sometimes more, sometimes less. But I think there always was a big awareness of the contract and that this is an important success factor also for Qt. Now we see that the commercial direction of Qt has changed, I would say, quite a bit. The model is a bit different there. The company does, I would say, less for the community than before. So you see that with the maintenance branches and so on. This, of course, creates these questions. How do we deal with that? And in KDE, we have, especially with the Qt 6, porting KDE to to Qt 6, with this transition, KDE has, of course, a huge effort there. I recently actually looked up a blog entry I wrote many years ago for Qt. Qt KDE, I don't know, 4 or 5 or something, where I tried to extrapolate how long it would take us to do the transition. And I think I underestimated by a year or something like that, just because KDE is a lot of code and not enough people who enjoy these porting efforts. So from this, of course, there's a problem, I think, the community, it's all still in the legal rights of what the Qt company can do according to the contract, also to the license and so on. And it's, I think, fair for them to decide what is best for their business. But then, of course, somehow the community has to cope with that or also try to influence that where it's possible, because I think some of the decisions the Qt company has taken in the past probably were not only not in the interest of the community, but also not in the interest of customers and also not in their own interest, I would say.
I mean, the world has changed. When I initially... It must be 13, 14 years ago where I had a small stint at the Oslo office and we did training material. And then the pitch was really that Qt is a cross desktop platform thingy and the portability was key. And then I guess I've always sort of looked at it as it was a direction change during Nokia towards devices.
Yeah.
But also if you look at the world today, the focus isn't desktop anymore. Saying that to KDE guy might be hurtful. Sorry, no offense intended. But I mean, it's turned into devices, and that changes the business model somewhat into license fees per device rather than license fees per developer and finding a balance there. So,
yeah, I hope this was the year of the Linux desktop.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm living in this perpetual year of the Linux desktop, so I really enjoy that.
I got a Pine phone, so now I have the year of the Linux phone instead. I've given up on the desktop.
You can put it on your desktop. So we're talking about from Qt down to KDE, but I'm interested in how much code flows from KDE back to Qt. You get the question, I hope.
Yeah.
And how is that regulated with copyright assignments, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually, because this also illustrates one of the problems which was there at the beginning. At the beginning, when Qt started, this was not possible. So Qt would not accept patches from the outside. because of copyright reasons or because they wanted to own everything and they wanted to have full control and they ran the CI and everything. So there was no open governance model. And this was only later introduced, I think during Nokia times mostly. So it took a while to introduce that, which made it possible to contribute at all. So at the beginning, especially at the very beginning, when Qt also was not as mature and KDE was also doing a lot of development around the libraries, there was more like this informal thing that people would just talk to each other and then the Qt engineer would write the patch which is necessary, or somehow they would transfer that, or they would hire a KDE person. And I mean, that happened quite a couple of times. So, and with the open governance model, this changed. So this made it possible to contribute to Qt in a regular way. But the copyright still, or the rights of the copyright, which allow Qt to also sell a proprietary version. What's the dual license business model? This requires this contributor license agreement. So you have to sign that when you contribute to Qt, but then it's possible. And CLAs are controversial as well. Some companies like them. Some companies feel that they are necessary for such a case as dual licensing and selling a proprietary version. You need them. It is necessary, but it's of course an imbalance because that's rights the company has and the contributor doesn't have. And the KD3 Qt Foundation counters this imbalance in some way. So I think that's a way how to also put it, that if I contribute to Qt, then I give the Qt company more rights than I have on Qt, and that's fine because that sustains the business, and that's also fine because I have the guarantee by the KDE3 Qt Foundation that the company will not just take the stuff and run away, but if they do that, I get my code back in some way and can run a business model on that. And with the introduction of open governance, it changed completely how KDE contributed to Qt. I mean, before they contributed by people in some way. And after it was possible, there was a massive effort to port back changes we did in KDE or additional wrappers, libraries, classes, extensions of classes, and so on, to put them back into Qt. So for some time, we operated under the vision to merge KDE back into Qt, or merge the KDE libraries back into Qt. And this succeeded, I think, to some degree. I mean, there are still KDE frameworks around, and we use them. And there's, of course, code which doesn't fit into Qt, but this has changed a lot. I think nowadays it's less because there's less work, and also I think the focus of the KDE community has shifted a bit because it's much more distributed now, much more focused on applications, individual applications. They all have their own communities. It's not the one big KDE community anymore, which creates this unified desktop and everybody works on everything. So nowadays, I think the motivation to contribute to Qt probably is a bit lower in the KDE community. But that also might be just my view. I know that there are still people contributing and enjoy that and benefit from that.
I mean, it seems to be a lot of collaboration around the desktop standards and things like that. And I'm thinking about Wayland and driver support and how to, I mean, it's quite interesting that Kwin, for instance, is a separate Wayland compositor than the Qt Wayland one. And as I understand, there is knowledge shared definitely between the two different Qt-based implementations of a Wayland compositor then, for instance.
Yeah.
But then you have the KDE frameworks, which I think is a real gem that people often miss. I mean, it's not on the front page of KDE, so to speak, but there's lots of handy things in there. Having K-Archive to handle zip files saved me hours of work instead of having to wrap something manually in C++.
Right. Yeah, I think all these things are born from practice. I mean, KDE created that over now more than two decades to create the things which were missing in Qt. So we had to write them ourselves. And so there's sometimes you see that some things maybe are too practical, so they don't have the greatest APIs or something. That's on the other hand a big strength of Qt, that they have this really, really good API design and they implement things properly and provide the interfaces in a way which are really intuitive and good. But the practical parts of then actually taking these APIs and making applications from it, that's something which KDE, of course, did a lot. And yeah, you're right, there are lots of gems in the KDE frameworks. There are also some things where you would say, okay, that's maybe a little bit more historical and you can see maybe you don't need that anymore. But then on the other hand, you also have these new things which come from, for example, the development which happens on phones or other mobile devices and which brings in new technology. So that there also still is innovation there. So I really like that. I mean, the frameworks are a huge thing and they are certainly understaffed. We don't have enough developers to really maintain them. But that also, on the other hand, is an advantage in that they are stable and they are not changing in a radical way. So you can rely on them and just use them and they will work.
I can't leave the the thoughts about who's contributing to who. So who's contributing to KDE the most? Is it companies? Is it private developers? Or
I think KDE always has been volunteer driven. So it was mostly volunteers, which were not so professionals, so people working for companies, professional software developers. I mean, I think that's a common scenario in open source that you have people who know what they do. So it's not amateurs, but they're not paid by a company to do the exact work they do. And this has been the model in KDE, I think, from the beginning, and it hasn't changed much. Of course, we also always had company contributions when projects happened with around KDE software. So we had some of the more famous and bigger projects, like, for example, what in Germany the BSI did, the agency for information security. They developed groupware or invested quite a bit of effort into the groupware part of KDE, so contact, email, and so on, to also port that to other platforms and make it available on Windows and Mac. And so this is one example where we had quite a bit of paid project work going into KDE. And then, of course, we always also had people who were employed by companies who gave people the freedom to work on KDE. So in some cases, for example, the Linux distributions, I mean, that also has changed a bit. So at the time when people were still chasing the year of the Linux desktop and it was really a big argument for selling the new version of a Linux distribution to have the latest version of KDE on it, then the distributions also employed more people to just work on KDE. So for example, SUSE in Germany, I mean, they had a team of several core KDE contributors to work on KDE and to advance that because it was critical for their business at that time. So this has changed now. Of course, Linux distributions are usually not very desktop centric anymore. The desktop centric distributions are probably also more volunteer driven. So there, I think, is less involvement. But then on the other hand, you have other projects which are happening and also investment going into that. Yeah.
Do you have these contribution graphs for KDE? I know, wasn't it Tiago who started maintaining them for Qt? Basically looking at the domain of the emails.
So. Yeah. Yeah, we had a time at KDE when we had some people working on these graphs and these statistics. I don't know if that is still happening in this. Those people, I think, are not doing it anymore. It also has become much more difficult with our move to Git, when all the KDE code was in one big Subversion repository. Then statistics were easier. Nowadays, you have to track all the Git repositories and understand how they relate and what is activity and what not. So it's harder, I think. There certainly are statistics, but at the moment I'm I don't know any numbers or anything.
Do you know by any chance how many active developers you have in KDE? I don't have a proper definition of what I mean with active, but
I think what we usually say is a couple of hundred. So I think we have probably thousands of developer accounts. Not all of them are active, but it's also very distributed, and it depends, of course, also how you count. I mean, we have, for example, many translators who are active and do great work, but they are usually not writing code and they are working in a bit different way. So sometimes it's also not as visible what they are doing and compared to developers. And then, of course, you have the core stuff on the frameworks and the core KDE applications. But you also have pretty much independent communities like for example Krita, which has their own organization even, and which operates as part of KDE, but has a lot of things which are managed by the project in a specific way. So I'm always surprised how many people know KDE. Being a long-term KDE contributor is great, because you always meet these people who say, "Oh yeah, I used KDE back then in 1998 and it was great." And I think the impact of KDE has been quite big, also beyond just the people who were developing it or even who were using it, because it was one of the biggest open source projects in the time when it started. It became really big, and nowadays, of course, we have tons of huge open source projects, and we have this massive projects like Kubernetes and all the cloud native stuff and whatever. I mean, there are so many open source projects around that it's really hard to keep track, and it's also hard to manage that. So KDE has a different challenge there, I think. But what also I always like about KDE that it really has been very stable. So there always was activity. There never was a time when we had to fear the project would die. And part of that is community. Part of that is culture. Part of this the people. Also the taking in new generations. Another part of that, of course, is also the stability of the organization, and also the stability of the legal framework with the licenses and with the KDE Qt Foundation agreement. So I think it's a very healthy combination of factors, which allows a lot of people to be active there, and also always new people to find a home at KDE. So we have accepted a couple of applications in KDE over time, which came from a complete other direction. Now, not everything started in KDE, but we have this kind of incubation program for many years now, where we give applications or communities or teams who need that or who can benefit from a bigger platform and stable organization behind that, we give them the opportunity to join us. And if the values align and the technology is not conflicting, then this is usually a win-win situation.
But a side note, I think it was 1998, 1999, perhaps, I started to use KDE on an old Solaris. Do you know if there is any project out there, open source or free software, that has a similar setup as KDE has with Qt?
Yeah, as I said, I don't think there's any project which has the same kind of agreement in this community contract term. Of course, there are lots of projects now where you have a company driving a product as open core or something, and then you have a community. Usually, I would say the community is more dependent on the company or more built by the company. So if you look at the big single vendor projects, which in some cases I even have moved away from being open source, like I don't know, MongoDB or Elasticsearch and so on, these projects which are huge single vendor projects. So there you see similar things, but that's more, I think, corporate driven. KDE never was, always was, I think, on eye level with the company. So it was never this, the company builds a community to support their product. But then, of course, I think you certainly can find examples where you also have independent organizations and independent companies. I mean, in sometimes founders of projects found a company and then leave the company again and still run the project and so on. But it's hard to compare because it's really in the details then. But I think that this formal act of balancing the interests in the community with legal means by a contract, I think that's actually pretty unique.
Circling back a bit on that topic, because I think we missed one part when we discussed it first time around. But what's the current status, so to speak? So Qt6 is covered by the by the contract, and then is sort of made available by the Qt company, and then as I understand it, KDE maintains, let's call it, convenience branch, which corresponds to the LTS branch that the Qt company provides, based on sort of merging patches and make it available to the community then.
Yeah, exactly. So this is one of the decisions the Qt company has taken, that they only offer the long-term support for older branches to paying customers. So this is not available in the same way for the community anymore. As we discussed before, moving between major versions is a huge effort. So obviously KDE needs a stable base for that until everything is available in Qt6 and all the porting work has been done. And for that, KDE now maintains a collection of patches, basically, which are required and which fix critical issues and so on. The policy there is that it should only be patches which already are in Qt6 or in the development branch, so that it's not a fork, it's not a different version. The idea is to keep that as close to Qt as possible, so it's not an independent effort. I would also hope that the collaboration there is happening in the same way as it happened in the past, that the Qt engineers are working with the community people to make sure that patches are working and stuff is available and critical issues are fixed and so on. The availability of the code now is in form of this patch collection for Qt. And this is also, it's interesting, it reminds me of the good old days, because KDE always was maintaining something like that. Not always, actually, but for a very long time. As I said, and... exactly, this Qt copy module. As we said before, it wasn't possible to contribute to Qt before. So KDE had to do that. And Qt copy always was more convenient thing for building the software. So having an easier checkout. And then after some, and I looked it up, actually. It was around almost from the beginning. So it really is a very, very old thing to have this Qt copy. And at some point, people started to also patch things. So sometimes have pre-release patches, something like that, or stuff which was still in development, or in some cases also KDE used that to move to a newer Qt version, so using a better version or something like that as Qt copy to have a stable and common base for everybody to work on, or at least an agreement on what is the expected state of Qt we are developing against. And today, I think it's less focus on these, going to newer versions, but more like we need the stability and we need the availability of the old version still around. So we maintain that, and I think the KDE community is a natural place for that, because we in some way, also through the agreement with the KDE Free Qt Foundation, we are a steward for the community part of Qt in some way. And so by collecting these patches in one location so that KDE can use it, but also that distributions can ship it, for example, that's, I think, a good move, which hopefully yeah, also remove some of the redundant work which otherwise would have been done. So it would make sense if every Linux distribution does the same patches just for themselves. So we still have to see how this develops over a longer time. So it has been announced. It's around now. KDE is using it. So I think some questions are still open there. But I think the general approach is quite pragmatic in the end. Yeah, we have to see how the success of that will be. I mean, we all hope that the Qt company is successful from a business point of view. That's the foundation we all rely on. But on the other hand, of course, also we need something from the company to be able to do the community work. And I think there's a mutual benefit which is there, where openness I think is advantageous, and it's good for the company to yeah, make sure the community can actually work in a way which is yeah, good for both sides and which doesn't put hurdles in the way. I'm always a fan of aligning the interests there, so that the community interests are not opposing the company interests and the other way around, because in the end, the success is just bigger if you work together in the same direction and not try to fight your customers or fight your users in some way by trying to yeah, get more business. The long-term strategy certainly is adoption through the community and monetizing the needs of then customers who need more than just an open source version.
And it's impressive to, I mean, looking back at it, just keeping it together across, I mean, the industry has changed, or the focus of where Qt is used as a technology, but also, I mean, you've had, what is it, four owners on the Qt side, if you consider Digi and Trolltech, or the Qt company separate entities. Yeah. If you start counting names for the Qt company during Nokia days, I guess we're approaching 10 or something. Qt software, Qt development frameworks.
Oh yeah,
yeah. But it's an old hairy beast.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we're slowly running out of time, so perhaps we should pause there for a bit, and we will see when we talk next time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I mean, it's an interesting topic, interesting people, interesting community. So I always enjoy discussing these these questions, and also to I somehow see it in my role to also yeah, remember the history and sometimes bring some of the things which I learned over time and the community learned over time, which the people who join the community now, of course, have not experienced themselves, to keep some of the lessons learned alive. So that's always a good thing to talk about this stuff, and also the current situation, of course. So thank you for having me. It was fun.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great.
We will link, by the way, your talk you did at FOSDEM.
Yeah, exactly. That's so great. There will be links in the description if you watch it as a video, or in the links collection for the episode if you watch it or listen to it as a pod, definitely. And don't forget Call for Papers on Sunday. Yeah.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.